Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Thanks, as always, to Kipper the Cat and the team, and welcome back to Evening Under Lamplight, or just plain welcome if this is your first visit. New people keep coming in all the time, and they are always welcome, and everyone is always invited to attend. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and our medium here is Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city, FM, digital or streaming at cambridge105.co.uk or archived at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk. Click the Evening Under Lamplight link. The archives go back many years, plenty there to enjoy. And if you've been following us for the past year or so, you'll know that we have been attending to Dante's Inferno, going a little deeper into hell each show. We've now come to canto 31 out of 34 cantos, very near the end. And maybe it's time for a little recapitulation or review of the ground we've covered. Well, first, we found Dante in the middle of the road of our life, lost in a dark wood, or rather, waking up to his condition of being lost. That awakening is the important part. Who knows how long he'd been wandering lost? Certainly he doesn't. But now he realizes that the ego-led life he'd been living is getting him nowhere. He tries to raise himself up towards the healing sun, but he finds himself blocked whichever way he goes, blocked by ferocious wild beasts. He can't get out of this by his own efforts to rise. He has to heal by some other way, some way of submission and descent into the depths before rising to the heights. And so he meets the shade of Virgil, the great Latin poet whom Dante had always considered his master, both for literary and political reasons. Virgil tells Dante that he had been doing his usual things down in the region of Limbo, where virtuous pagans reside after death, when he was approached by Beatrice, Dante's ideal lady, now a messenger from St. Mary and St. Lucy, to ask Virgil to rescue Dante and lead him through the proper paths up to a heavenly vision. This will mean, first of all, a descent into the underworld, the world below, or in Italian, inferno. And so down they go, into that huge, funnel-shaped hole carved out of the innermost part of the earth, broken up by 9 concentric circles. There are 3 main divisions of hell, corresponding to the sins of incontinence, violence, and fraud. In the area of incontinence, that means sins of overindulgence, taking good things and just going too far with them or taking them in the wrong direction, in the area of incontinence are 3 circles. First, there's lust, not meaning strong sexual desire as we use the word, but the passive surrender to sexual and other desires that we know are wrong. Dante's poetic image for this state of the soul is to picture them here, being blown about round and round by infernal tempests, getting nowhere, out of control, knowing just how miserable they are. Going 90 miles an hour down a dead-end street. And wait a minute. Let me interrupt myself for a moment and use this opportunity to play one of my favorite Dylan songs, though not written by Dylan. I took you home from the party and we kissed in fun, a few stolen kisses and no harm was done. Instead of stopping when we could, we went right on, till suddenly we found that the brakes were gone. You belong to someone else, and I do too. It's just crazy being here with you. As a bad motorcycle with the devil in the seat, going 90 miles an hour down a dead-end street. This is a song about Dante's lustful, lost souls.
I took you home from a party and we kissed in fun. A few stolen kisses and no harm was done. Instead of stopping when we could, we went right on. Till suddenly we found that the brakes were gone. You belong to someone else, and I do too. It's just crazy being here with you. As a bad motorcycle with the devil in the seat, going 90 miles an hour down a dead end street. I didn't want you, and now I have no choice. It's too late to listen to that warning voice. All I hear is thunder, oh, two hearts beat, doing 90 miles an hour down a dead end street. Yeah. Warning signs are flashing everywhere, but we pay no heed. Instead of slowing down the pace, we keep picking up speed. Disaster's getting closer every time we meet. Doing 90 miles an hour now to dead end street.
Bob Dylan covering 90 miles an hour down a dead-end street. Disaster's getting closer every time we meet, going 90 miles an hour down a dead-end street. I hope you loved that deep performance, the voice woefully aware of the pain his incontinent desire has led him into. The other cycles of incontinence show us the gluttons, miserably exposed naked to a constant shower of freezing rain and sleet, rolling around in the stinking mud, and then those who hoarded money too much, the misers, banging into the spendthrifts who spent money too much. So Dante tells us there's nothing wrong with desire in itself for sex, food, money, or anything else. In fact, desire is essential for a fully human life. But when we give in to desires we know are wrong or excessive, then we are ruining our soul. But then Dante passes over the intermediate region of anger, a swamp where the souls are just ripping themselves and each other apart, while under the water, the sullen, despairing souls just gurgle in inarticulate misery and regret. And next comes the circle for the violent souls, with three subsections. First, those who have been violent to others, immersed in a river of boiling blood, some just ankle-deep, but the really violent ones entirely submerged. Then those who have been violent to themselves, the suicides, now transformed into dead thorn trees and thorn bushes, bearing no fruit, and those who mindlessly wasted their possessions, since one's possessions were regarded as part of oneself. And the final group are those who have been violent against God, blasphemers, those who have used their bodies in unproductive ways, and those moneylenders who made money out of money, which, in a complicated way we discussed before and I won't go into here, means that they abused the riches of God's world. And then the final grouping, for fraud or deceiving other people just for one's own ends. Dante divides fraud into two categories, fraud simple and fraud complex. Fraud simple involves what we might call public fraud. All those people out there trying to get the better of us, seducers, corrupt church people and politicians, flatterers, hypocrites, and so on. These souls are dumped into nine different ditches, each ditch ingeniously corresponding to the different kinds of deceit they practiced. We've just finished going through all of those. And now we're getting ready to attend to fraud complex. We somehow expect, or should expect, politicians, advertisers, promoters of all sorts and so on, we expect them to try to defraud us. But we do not expect fraud from our relations, our guests or our hosts or our disciples. That kind of fraud, more like betrayal or treachery, is the worst sin in Dante's scheme. All his sins disrupt the life of the community, but fraud complex completely breaks down any communal spirit. But we don't move immediately from fraud simple to fraud complex. Fraud complex is on a different level, and somehow Dante and Virgil have to find a way to get down to that lower level. And that's where we'll be attending to this evening under lamplight, as we allow Dante to take us down, because he's going too.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Field. Nothing is real. I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. No one I think is in my tree. I mean, it must be high or low. That is, you can't, you know, tune in, but it's all right. That is, I think it's not too bad. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry feels forever. Always know, sometimes think it's me, but you know I know when it's a dream. I think I know, I mean, yes, but it's all wrong. That is, I think I disagree. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Field. Nothing is real, nothing to get hung about. Strawberry feels forever. Strawberry feels forever. Strawberry feels forever.
Strawberry Fields, nothing is real and nothing to get hung about, because living is easy with eyes closed, misunderstanding all you see. It's getting hard to be someone, but it all works out. It doesn't matter much to me. John Lennon is presumably describing some sort of surreal psychedelic experience, but it occurs to me that it also describes the state of the soul all the way down here, where they all have completely lost il ben dell'intelletto, the good of the intellect, so that it gets very hard to be someone. It all works out because you're given a place here that completely matches the condition you have created for your soul. Oh yes, it's not just the state of the soul after we die, but this is a universal poem after all, but the state of our soul at any given moment in which we lose the good of our intellect and allow ourselves to defraud others. Well, we left Dante and Virgil as they turned their backs on the inane, futile quarreling of the diseased falsificador, falsifiers. And remember, Dante, like us, was fascinated by the nasty quarrelling two of these diseased souls were engaged in, too rotten in their body to do more than slap out physically at each other, but able to hurl insults back and forth. "Keep gawking at these two," Virgil said to Dante, "and I'll start quarrelling with you." Dante is filled then with shame at having lost his focus for that time, and Virgil then consoled him, saying that his immediate shame when becoming aware of going wrong was enough to have offset even more serious wrongdoing. And then, as our canto begins, and the two are walking on, Dante explains that the same tongue that stung him with the reproach was also the one that healed the shame that had arisen from the reproach. And he compares that to Achilles' lance, which supposedly had the property of healing someone who had been wounded by it. Achilles could stab or slash someone with the sharp tip of the lance, but then if he touched the person with the blunt end, the wound would be healed. There are variations about this healing spear. In some versions, the person wounded by the spear could be healed if Achilles applied some some rust from the spear onto the wound. But I find it hard to imagine that such a great warrior as Achilles would have allowed his spear to gather any rust. Another tradition said that the person could be healed only if Achilles wounded him again with the same spear. But the basic image remains the same. The weapon that caused the wound can also heal the wound. So we have here an image of the hurt that heals. Virgil's tongue, as we see, can do both. Dante's whole journey through hell, and our journey along with him, hurts. Our imagination is wounded by all that we have seen and heard, but through this hurt, we grow stronger, better able to recognize and identify the vicious tendencies that might arise within ourselves and thus avoid them, or at least repent of them. The image also helps us look forward to what's coming up next after Dante comes out of the infernal regions of the Inferno. He'll rise up the mountain of purgatory, where he'll see all the saved souls of the people whose shame for their sins led to repentance before they died. And on the circles of this towering mountain, the souls will suffer torments almost as dire as those suffered in hell, with the exception that these pains are purging purgatory, get it? Purging them of their sins as they work out the poison within them, so they can then be all healed and whole when, after being cleansed in purgatory, they rise up to heaven or paradise for eternal joy. By the way, don't worry, we're not going to continue going through all of the cantos of Purgatorio and Paradiso. I think I'll devote one show to a general overview of purgatory and another to paradise. Since having come so far, we might as well at least glance at what Dante gives us next. The two later parts of the Divine Comedy are actually much richer poetry and give us a much more exalted view of human life, but the actual incidents are not as vivid or engaging as those in the Inferno. And I don't think you'd really want to spend a lot of time here. Yes, of course, read them in an edition with good notes, but they wouldn't make good radio. So let's move on to this evening's canto now. So now we join Dante and Virgil as they are walking on to the next region. It was, Dante says, men che notte e men che giorno. Less dark than night, but certainly less bright than day. Mezzo, mezzo. And before he can see anything, he hears something first. As he's coming closer, he hears a tremendous blast on a horn, a kind of alarm or warning. It's as if, in our world, you were walking gingerly in a dark, unknown, dangerous place, and suddenly you heard the security alarm going off, blaring loud enough to alert the whole area. Where did that blast come from? Where is he headed? There's just light enough for Dante to discern that there is something up ahead, some huge towers. Have they come to the walls of yet another city, the innermost city of the realm of hell, with its towers and walls? The last time they encountered a walled city, they were denied entrance, and an angel had to come down to their assistance. Will they be stopped here too? We miss the feel of this passage if we don't catch the frightening urgency here to know just what's going on. Are those towers, and are we coming to another city? Dante asks Virgil. No, Virgil says, your eyesight is deceived by the distance. Don't try to guess what's coming up ahead. Wait till you get there. Or better yet, he says, let me just give you an idea of what we're coming to. They aren't towers, but giants. They're standing in a huge pit at the centre of hell, the centre of the earth, in fact, and we are seeing only that part above their navel. The rest of their huge form, from the waist to the feet, is down below. That's some sort of comfort to Dante, I suppose, to know what's up ahead, but the closer he comes, and the more clearly he makes out these figures, the more his initial bewilderment turns into paralyzing fear. Fugie mi errora, e cresce mi paura. Error left me, and fear grew within me. And what will he find when he gets up really close to them? That was another moment from Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, The Gnomes. And here's a wee reminder that you're listening to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson.
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend Evening Under Lamplight. It's Cambridge 105. Community radio in your city.
Thank you. Now, there are several ghosts ranged around the perimeter of this circular pit at the centre of the world. The first that Dante sees is Nimrod, whose massive face, chest, shoulders and belly, and arms hanging by his side are so horrible that Dante feels grateful that natura lasciò l'arte di si fatti animali, grateful that nature has abandoned the craft of making such creatures. They no longer exist. Notice that Dante is quite ready to accept the idea that there were once giants living on the earth. He had a biblical precedence for this view that there had been warlike giants on the earth who perished. The apocryphal book of Baruch tells us there were the giants, those renowned men that were from the beginning, of great stature, expert in war. The Lord chose not them, neither did they find the way of knowledge. Therefore did they perish. And because they had not wisdom, they perished through their folly. Big, dumb, dangerous creatures, as opposed to other large animals like elephants and whales, who are just big, and because they're relatively harmless, they have survived into our days. But these giants combine the power of thought with ill will and great strength, and there's no refuge from that. It's like having someone with a spiteful, immature, emotional makeup being given the great strength of a high political office, as we see these days. Dante gives some odd measurements to get us to calculate just how tall this giant is, but I'll spare you the game he sets up and just say that we reckon that Nimrod is about 35 feet tall from the point at which we see him, which means, adding on the other half of his body that's hidden below the rim of the pit, that this giant is 70 feet tall. That's impressive, sort of. But I confess, I cannot really picture what 70 feet high would look like. And do I need a precise picture in my mind? Well, it would be nice, but it's not really necessary, as long as I remember that this height is as overwhelming and dizzyingly frightening. If I remember that, I get the point. But besides being so huge, Nimrod is also a gibbering monster. He shouts out, "Raphael, maya meke, sabialmi." Lots of commentators have tried to make sense of these words, but I agree with what Hollander says. The point is not that these words make any sense. It is rather that they do not. Nimrod's cry is the product of anger and menace common to all infernal guardians. Whatever they mean or don't mean, the intent is clear. They are a warning not to come any closer. A warning, of course, that Virgil has no intention of heeding. "Hey," Virgil says, I'm paraphrasing. "Hey, don't try to be clever and use words you can't get your mind or tongue around. Just vent your passion through blowing on your horn. What's the matter, anima confusa, scatterbrain? Did you forget your horns hanging right there around your neck?" Nimrod, of course, is too stupid even to comprehend Virgil's words. But as Hollander says, it matters not at all that Nimrod cannot understand. The reader can. And who was Nimrod? You might remember Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord, from the book of Genesis. And that's why he has a horn. All hunters have horns. It was Nimrod who conceived the idea of building the Tower of Babel. Shall we attend to the original Babel story? It's only a few compressed lines long. Attend. "And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And they said to one another, 'Go to, let us make brick and burn them throughly.' And they had brick for stone, and slime had they for mortar. And they said, 'Go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. And let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth.' And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, 'Behold, the people is one, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do.'" Or to make it a little more Yiddish, "They have all one language, and this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech.' So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth."
Like a seed that is sown, all the children are scattered by a breeze that is blown. Now the crops are all scattered. We are torn, we are shattered. Now some of us are balmy and battered, and the fields where we gathered are overgrown in weeds and in tatters. Through it all, we were scattered. To the fields we are scattered, from the day we are born, to grow wild and sleep rough, till from the earth we are torn. And a soul that is free can live on eternally, and a spirit can live on, though we're scattered in the world beyond. And I've been out of my mind ever since you've been gone. Now my life is all scattered ever since she's been gone. I feel older, I feel fatter, I feel the blues coming on. We get bruised, we get battered, but we'll pick up the pieces that scattered, and with emotional glue we're gonna stick together, body and mind. Ever since she went away, I've been sitting in my solitude, I've watched the stars and wondered why they're scattered up there in the sky. And is she up there out of view on some high latitude? To the fields we are scattered, then from the dust we are born. We survive somewhat battered, to a new life, a new dawn. In the end, what will it matter? There'll only be my ashes to scatter, and all the logical answers to a worrying mind will be scattered in time. Beaten and battered, to the earth you are scattered. You're going home, so what does it matter? To an atomic mind, scattered here while you travel time.
The King's song, Scattered, the final single they released. It's the desolate cry of the scatterbrained and devastated soul. Now my life is all scattered ever since she's been gone. I feel older, I feel fatter, I feel the blues coming on. We get bruised, we get battered, but we'll pick up the pieces that scattered, and with emotional glue, we're going to stick together, body and mind. It's a song in part about the death of Ray Davis' mother, but then it extends to the Babel myth of scattered humanity, what we all come to, what we experience in our ways every day. Now, Nimrod, remember him, Nimrod isn't mentioned in the Genesis account of the Tower of Babel, but he is associated with this moment in biblical history, or legend, or myth. This is, after all, a myth that explains why we speak so many different languages. But we must never assume that myths are just simple-minded explanations by people who know no better. Myths explain the origin of things in a way that, yeah, it's not scientific, but that's because it's deeper than science. It gives the moral and psychological significance of the thing. So what do we learn here? The people were one, all united, and speaking one language was the symbol of this unity. But what did they do with this wonderful unity? They decided to build a tower up to heaven just for vainglory's sake, to make a name for themselves. They were afraid that otherwise they would be scattered all over. In other words, instead of preserving their unity internally by living in accord with one another, they looked outside and at what others would think of them, others like God. And once they did this, they lost their inner unity. Each saw the outside world in a slightly different way and expressed it in a different way, and so they all moved off into different languages. And even if they spoke the same tongue, they used it differently. It takes two to speak truth, Thoreau said, one to speak and another to hear, and if they are no longer looking at each other, but are looking to make a name for themselves instead, then how can they ever come to any truth between them? They're looking in different directions, their language is different, their community is lost. That's why Dante places Nimrod here in the pivot between the two kinds of fraud. And that's why he has Nimrod speak gibberish, the language of the mindless, che hanno perduto il ben dell'intelletto. And although Nimrod is never mentioned in the Bible as a giant, Dante takes the liberty of picturing him here as gigantic, and why not? The myths are fluid and allow us to vary the details so long as we keep the main points intact. And here, Dante is reminding us of the gigantic catastrophe that arose once Nimrod's project collapsed into an unintelligible confusion of language. But we can't attend to Nimrod without also bringing in at least a little bit of Elgar's Nimrod, one of his Enigma variations. I think it gives a feeling more of a calm sadness leading to an expansive peacefulness rather than the kind of mindless insanity of Dante's Nimrod. But perhaps this calm sadness is appropriate not so much for Nimrod himself, but for our own feelings as we contemplate the wreck of the once great Nimrod.
Thank you.
Well, that was an enigma, wasn't it? And so much for Nimrod. Dante and Virgil leave him and move on, and soon come up to the second giant, Più Ferro e Maggio, bigger and more savage. Being more savage, he's more constrained. In fact, he's bound in chains, passing five times around him, at least as far down as Dante can see, binding his right arm behind him and his left arm in front of him. This is Ephialtes. Dante would expect his readers to recognize the name, but all modern readers are going to need a footnote or a radio commentator to help out. There are many versions of the Ephialtes story, but the one Dante refers to depicts him as one of the giants who attacked the Olympian gods in what was known as the Gigantomachy, the Battle of the Giants. In order to assault the heavens, Ephialtes ripped up a few mountains, as one does, and piled them on top of each other before Jupiter killed him with one of his mighty thunderbolts, Jupiter's special weapon. Notice the parallels. Nimrod tried to climb up to heaven with the Tower of Babel. Ephialtes also tried to climb to heaven, though he was too dumb to use architecture, or so strong he didn't have to bother. These giants who try to climb to the heights are now confined in the lowest depths. Anyone who tries to climb up to heaven to bring down the mightiest gods is going to be a dangerous threat wherever he is, so we can quite understand the need to have him chained. In Greek, Ephialtes means he who jumps upon, with the additional meaning of nightmare. I suppose because nightmares feel like they've just jumped upon us in our sleep. No wonder Dante is so frightened at the sight of him. Here, at the pit of hell, reside all our nightmares. And now Dante, looking up at the giant Ephialtes, starts thinking of another giant, one he had read about in Virgil's Aeneid. This is Briareus, one of the more preposterous monsters in ancient mythology. Virgil describes him as having 100 arms and hands and breathes fire from 50 mouths and breasts. Or so they say, Virgil cannily adds. It is this monster that Dante wants to see. Well, who wouldn't? What exactly does such a creature look like? How do those 100 arms attach to the body? Or those 50 mouths? Or those breasts? What kind of breasts, anyway? Please, if it's possible, he says to Virgil, I'd like to see for myself the immeasurable giant Briareus. No, sorry, Virgil says. Briareus is chained up farther along this circle than we're going to travel. All I can tell you is that he's chained up just like Ephialtes here. In fact, he's pretty similar to Ephialtes here, but even more fierce and frightening. Hearing this, Ephialtes struggles in anger against his chains. What an insult to say that someone else is more frightening than he is. But it's frustrated rage. Those chains hold him fast. All he can do is struggle, like a mighty tower rocked by an earthquake. It's enough to frighten Dante almost to death, and he says it would have killed him if he hadn't noticed that those chains were holding tight. And so they continue around the circle to the next giant, who is the one they want, Antaeus. He's not chained up, nor is he an idiot like Nimrod. He's the one, Virgil says, who will help us get down to the next level. Who is Antaeus? He was one of the mythical giants, the son of Poseidon and Gaia, that is, the son of the sea god and the earth goddess. The sea and the earth are nurturing. They bear no active ill will, but they do, of course, have their moments. They can be dangerous at times, and thus so can Antaeus. His name basically means opponent. We know that anti from words like anti-slavery, anti-abortion, or antagonist. But mostly, I think, Antaeus is known for his great strength. He lived in North Africa and used to challenge anyone who came by to a wrestling match. A match he always won because once he got his opponent onto the ground, he could draw upon the strength of his Mother Earth to bring him victory. And then, such is the nature of such creatures, then he would, of course, kill his enemy. All very well until one day along comes Hercules on his way to fulfill his 11th of 12 labors. Here's the strongest man, Hercules, pitted against the strongest giant. How could Hercules win? He couldn't win until he realized that Antaeus' strength came from his connection to his mother Earth. And so, with a mighty effort, Hercules lifted Antaeus off the earth, so now he was, well, not exactly helpless, but at least no longer invincible. And finally, Hercules crushed him to death with the power of his mighty arms. So it is to this giant that Virgil appeals for help. Please, could you set the two of us down at Cocytus, that lowest level of hell? Virgil asks. You wouldn't want us to have to go to some of the other giants further on, would you? Let me tell you, this man here next to me, he's still alive and is going to return to the upper world and live on, probably for many years. He can build up your reputation out there if you do this, if you do us this favor. Okay, sure. The giant's willing, and he quickly reaches out his hand, palm up, and lets Virgil climb onto it. When he feels secure, Virgil reaches out for Dante and brings him on board, clutching him tightly so that they are like one bundle. And then Antaeus bends over to place them all the way down onto the ground below. And as if Dante hadn't been frightened already, well, this was really frightening, seeing that towering torso bend as if it were falling right on top of him. E fu tal ora che avrei voluto to ir per altra strada, Dante says. That was indeed a time I wished that I had gone another route.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real.
Can you imagine how Dante feels, so vulnerable in the palm of the unpredictable, capricious giant Antaeus? But the frightening descent is soon over, and Dante and Virgil are safe on the next and final level of the Inferno. From here, as Hollander says, everywhere is up. Well, not quite. They still have to pass through some really awful things before they finish with this level and start journeying out of there. So that's the end of the canto, but let's take a moment to consider what's been going on. Why should Dante introduce these giants here? What might they signify? Let's again go back to Dorothy Sayers, who has this to say about the giants. They are images of the blind forces which remain in the soul and in society when the general bond of love, that is, the community, is dissolved and the good of the intellect wholly withdrawn, and when nothing remains but blocks of primitive mass emotion fit to be the executive of Mars and the tools of treachery. Nimrod is a braggart stupidity, Ephialtes a senseless rage, Antaeus a brainless vanity. One may call them the doom of nonsense, violence, and triviality, overtaking a civilization in which the whole natural order is abrogated. And the note I've written in my book next to this passage says bluntly, this is where we are now. That note was written a few years ago. Where, then, are we now? Do we find ourselves coming up against a braggart stupidity, a senseless rage, and a brainless vanity? Well, you know what or whom I'm referring to. We don't have to belabor the point here. Let's just remember that Dante got here before we did. And this braggart stupidity, senseless rage, and brainless vanity signifies the entry into the complete breakdown of any kind of civility or community, a place where you cannot trust anyone. We have three more cantos to explore the horrors of this region, frozen in hatred. But no hatred here among us. We are a true community, coming together to attend and attend to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105. And I'm proud to be your host, Robert Louis Abrahamson. See you in a fortnight. Good night. Hey, we have a few seconds left before we have to close up for the news. I wonder what the news is going to bring us. More incivility, more dissolution of community, more of this nonsense, violence, and triviality. Use Dante to help you interpret what the news is going to tell.